I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Greetings, music nerds, and welcome to Season 7 of the Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast. I'm your host, Steve Dawson, coming to you from the Hen House Studio here in East Nashville, Tennessee. I'm so glad you've chosen to join me once again as we take some deep dives with a cast of wonderful musicians, producers, and engineers that I've managed to track down and speak to about making music, records, and just doing what they do in their lives in music. Don't forget, there's a link to a playlist on Spotify and Apple Music with links to many of the songs we discuss on today's episode. You'll find links to those playlists in the show notes below or at our website. Meanwhile, the show continues to be largely listener-supported. Your help in keeping the show going is always appreciated, and you can do it with a one-time donation or a Patreon subscription, which is a monthly payment of your choice. And when you sign up for Patreon, you get an ad-free version of the show to listen to, as well as getting entered to win a cunning prize pack from our sponsors at the end of the season. Or if you're tight for dough and you still want to help out, you can subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or just by spreading the word, sharing the show, following us on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook, and telling all your pals about it. You can get links to all this stuff at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Meanwhile, a huge thanks to the sponsors this season. Please check them out and let them know I sent you. They are Union Tube and Transistor, Spectra 1964, The Deering Banjo Company, Mule Resophonic Guitars, and The Hen House Hang. All right, thanks so much to you for tuning in, and let's get down to it. Howdy, music nerds, and welcome back to the show. This is episode number 149. My guest today is a legend, a true legend of the steel guitar, Mr. Al Perkins, and it was a real honor to have him. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. I sure appreciate you listening. I've been busy here mixing a bunch of albums and getting some arranging done for some shows this fall, and I do have some shows coming up both around Nashville and also out in Vancouver, and you can get info and tickets to shows over at my website, which is stevedawson.ca, and I do hope to see some of you out there somewhere this fall. You know, we had a big loss here in the Nashville music scene this week with Dave Rowe passing away. He was one of the great bass players of all time. He was sort of known, I guess, mostly as an upright bass player, but he was also a killer on electric bass. And I used to see him playing all the time around town here, and he was just a monster bass player with a big old groove and a massive tone. And the story with him was that, and I don't know how true this is, but I think it's true, is that Johnny Cash asked him to play upright bass with him. This is a long time ago, like in the early 60s maybe, or I don't know, mid 60s or something. And he asked Dave to play upright bass with him. And Dave was super young, and at that point apparently had never played the upright bass. But he said, yeah, man, I can do that. And so he started playing upright bass like that day for Johnny Cash. And he played with him for years. But I guess a couple weeks into that gig, he was sort of like fumbling his way through figuring out how to play the upright bass, which he was not used to playing. And Johnny eventually turned to him and said, you don't know how to play that thing, do you? And oh yeah, he was right. But he let it slide and he kept Dave on, and Dave played with him for years. And that's pretty damn cool if that's true. And I think it is. So thanks for all the great music, Dave Rowe. I would have loved to have him on this podcast, you know, but it just never happened. Dang. As a reminder, anyone that's a Patreon member will be automatically entered into the end of season contest, and the winner will be picked randomly from the Patreon subscribers. You can sign up for that with a minimum monthly payment to support the show, which is very much appreciated, over at the website makersandshakerspodcast.com. There's a donate link up in the top corner, and that will take you either to a one-time donation or to sign up for Patreon. And from the Patreon subscribers, I will be giving away a prize pack at the end of the year. And my friends over at the Union Tube and Transistor Company in Vancouver, they just sent me a bunch of wicked swag as well as three of their amazing guitar pedals to give away. And that's going to happen at the end of the season. So stay tuned for that. Sign up to the Patreon, support the show, and win some stuff. And I would just like to shout out to a new donor this week who was very generous and has signed up for the Patreon subscription, and that is Dan Martin. Thank you, Dan. Much appreciated. All right. So on the show today, we have Al Perkins. He is a true legend of the steel guitar. I've known his name for a long time because when I was in high school, weirdly, one of my favorite albums was called Manassas. And it was sort of a solo Stephen Stills record. Stephen Stills was already quite famous, and he had, you know, through Crosby, Stills, Nash and Buffalo Springfield. But he had this record called Manassas. And it wasn't clear if that was like the name of the record or if there was a band called Manassas. But it's a really cool, kind of blurry, timeless looking photo, and all the musicians are listed. And those were players that I was sort of familiar with from that like California country rock scene. And then Al Perkins, I didn't know his name at the time, but you know, I was in high school and I started listening to that record and loved it. It's always been a great record, and I still love that record to this day. So I highly recommend checking out Manassas and some of Al Perkins's great work on that. And Al grew up playing steel guitar as a little tyke in country bands on radio and TV around his home state of Texas, and eventually got in bands and moved to California. And he was in a band called Shiloh at that point, which also featured Don Henley, later of the Eagles. The California country scene is very incestuous in a way. And anyway, he ran into Kenny Rogers out there, who sort of took him under his wing. And Kenny at that time was like a rock star. He was in that band called First Edition, and they had a huge hit around that time called Just Dropped In to See What Condition My Condition Was In. And that's featured in The Big Lebowski, as we all know. Maybe it's time to go and watch that movie again. So Al was playing in Shiloh. Kenny Rogers was bringing him in to do sessions. And all this work eventually led to Al replacing the great, legendary Sneaky Pete in the Flying Burrito Brothers band, which was kind of an ever-revolving cast of characters, and one that featured members that went on to be members of The Byrds and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, and Gram Parsons was in the band through its different incarnations as well. Al ended up playing on Gram's two solo records. He also played on the Stones' Exile on Main Street. It's just one song, but man, what a session that must have been. And you'll hear a bit about that in a few minutes here. And from there, his credits through the 70s and 80s kind of go bananas, and he's playing all the time and doing tons of sessions. Then he cropped up again on my radar as a live player, as the dobro player in Emmylou Harris's Nash Ramblers. They made that great record called Live at the Ryman in the late 90s, which really has been given credit, rightly so, to saving the Ryman Auditorium, which is one of the great venues in America. And I guess it was just falling apart at that time, and Emmylou decided to put on a show there, and it, you know, the album was fantastic, and it won Grammys and brought all this attention to the Ryman. And then they were like, oh, maybe the Ryman's cool after all. And they invested a bunch of money, and now it is what it is, which is this legendary, great venue. So he was part of that band called the Nash Ramblers, which is amazing. And he continues to play sessions and occasionally gigs around town here. This one was tricky to get lined up, just technically and also for time. But Al's wife, Pamela, was kind enough to help out with some of the technical stuff on their end, getting the Zoom set up. And you can also hear her in the background with some factual information as well. So thanks to Pamela. And it was really fascinating to hear the stories about some of these sessions. And also, really, the technical side of things is of great interest to me, and I hope to you, too, as a listener. You have to remember that the pedal steel in those days, you know, the late 60s and early 70s, it was a very fluid and evolving instrument. People were customizing their instruments themselves. And Al has some great stories here about adding knee levers to his Fender steel using a gate hinge. And, you know, the pedal steel just didn't have a standard setup yet. So it was people like Al who really helped to innovate some of the things that the instrument does now, but way back then, before the manufacturers had figured out what it was that the musicians wanted. These people were doing it themselves, and eventually the industry caught up, and now there's kind of a standard. But at that time, it really wasn't like that. So you can get lots of info on Al at alperkinsmusic.com. And with that, please enjoy my conversation with Al Perkins. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about something that I find interesting with a lot of steel players is how they get into this crazy instrument in the first place. I know you play other instruments as well, but steel is something that, you know, you were kind of known for, especially back in the day. And growing up in Texas, which is, I think, where you're from, it's sort of more of the fabric of society there than it is where I'm from in Canada. But maybe you could talk a little bit about how you got into music and what drew you to the steel and how old you were when you started playing.
Well, back then it was probably in the mid-50s, around 54, 55, something like that. I was about 11 years old at that time. And I was into Sandlot baseball. You know, we had out in West Texas, you know, we had a lot of empty spaces where we could play. Mm-hmm. And but one day on a Saturday, my father was a truck driver. He was off. And there was a company up in Lubbock called Dunnigan School of Music. And they had instituted a lot of people in different counties and different states, actually, where they would offer Hawaiian steel guitar lessons. And it was called the Dunnigan School of Music. And it came about the same time as we would listen to Hawaii calls from the Trans-Pacific Line, you know, that went underground, went under the water, came up, and then they broadcasted, you know, all over the states. And so my dad was home. One of these fellas came by and knocked on the door and said, we're here with this Dunnigan School of Music. And we're putting in a class here in Odessa, Texas. That's where we were.
Yep.
And wondering if anybody would like to take steel guitar. My dad played a little bit of acoustic guitar, you know, and had one around the house. And he asked me, I was there. He says, what do you think about this? You think you'd like to play steel guitar, you know? And he said, I don't know. I said, and then he kind of lured me with something that was the wrong lure. He says, I think the girls like those musicians, you know?
Wow.
I didn't like it. Anyway, that was, anyway, we talked a little bit, and I ended up taking lessons from a genius steel guitar player named Hal Petty. At that time, he was just under 21. He couldn't sign for himself to get furniture and stuff like that when he just moved into town to teach. So my dad actually co-signed for him to get some furniture and that kind of thing. And I ended up in a group class there in Odessa for Hawaiian steel guitar. And they give you these little number charts, you know, like a 00 was open, you know, and
yep.
It would add 00 on the second, third string or whatever. And we would learn Hawaiian songs. And I remember being in a class, and we were learning the song for the next week, usually, you know, before we'd leave. He would play it for practice, and everybody would play it when they came back. Well, I did my own kind of little ad-libbing, you know. On one day, I was just doing it, you know, just for fun, I guess, you know. So, and he called me at it, and he said, "Al, is your father picking you up today?" And I said, "Yes, sir. I think he is." Says, "Would you mind staying and talking with me in the office?" So I thought, well, it's back to Sandlot baseball. So, which I didn't, you know, at that point, it didn't matter.
Yeah.
So my dad. Man, and he said, "Mr. Perkins, I noticed that your son was playing by ear instead of reading the chart." And he said, make a long story short, he said, "If you could afford to give him private lessons, I could teach him twice as fast." So you imagine a teacher doing that really is one thing, and somebody to recognize it at his age. But he was a genius, too. And that helped him, you know. And
was he sort of from the Western Swing school of playing, and the Hawaiian was like the method that was being used to teach kids at that time?
Correct. Yeah, you got it. Yeah, in the little group that he was in, they would play on TV, you know, and they'd play in different different towns around there at their, you know, whatever venue they had that was big enough to help people that wanted to come and listen to music. Bill Myrick was the fellow's name. And so he began having me and an older student who was teaching similarly to come out and play our guitars on their show, you know, like one or two songs, or in some cases we'd do three parts. Al Petty would play one and me and the other fellow would play the other. So
like pretty much from the book that you were learning from.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. I have some of those books, like some of those folios from the 20s and 30s that they were using through the 40s. And I've actually recently tried to, like, I've learned some because I'm so fascinated by that whole way of teaching people to play music. And it's actually pretty cool.
Yeah. We didn't actually, as I recall, we actually did that by memory when we were on stage, but we would take one of those songs and use that, you know?
Yeah. So was this a live performance or was it a radio broadcast that you were playing on?
These were live, shows, you know, on weekends. And during the week, I think sometimes Al Petty, the group with Bill Myrick, they would play in other places occasionally, but they had a TV show as well. And so that was early on in West Texas.
So what was your feeling like as a kid? Were you into it? Like, did you think it was cool or did you think, oh my God, this is so lame. I want to play some other kind of music? Or like, where was your head at as a kid at that point?
As a kid, you know, everything was relative. If Hawaiian music was popular, then that's kind of what we did. And Western swing was really big out there. And so we ended up doing some of that. I've had the experience with Western swing out there, but you know, I grew to love the really hardcore country things, yeah. You know, like Ernest Tubb and things like that too. You know.
Did you get a chance to start playing some of the more hardcore straight up country music that you were hearing and liked, or did that opportunity not really come up for a while?
I was in two groups, Hank Telford and the Trailblazers, Hank Telford and the Rhythm Makers. That was nice. The name of it. They had a little, you know, a little teardrop looking trailer, you know, that yeah. They carried bass fiddle in and everything.
Yeah.
And so that was my first group. I've got some pictures of them person in my father's living room or not their living room.
And you were young. You were just a kid. These were men.
Yeah, these were guys.
Grown people.
And so I played in that for a little bit. And the next one was Frank Dickens and the Trailblazers. And with Frank, we ended up having a TV show of our own. I have some pictures somewhere around here of us playing on that show.
So do you mean that was like the band leader's show and he would come on, it would sort of be like a variety show and there would be musical guests and stuff like that? Or like, what was the actual show?
Yeah, the actual show was sponsored by Pioneer Furniture Company, and they had several little commercial spots in there. But otherwise, we just played songs that people knew.
A Saturday morning.
Saturday morning?
Yeah. It was like Steve, I grew up in the same area as Al, and I probably saw them at one time, but I didn't know. it was like a little show, like a Saturday morning, like this Pioneer Furniture. Mostly it was like paid advertising for Pioneer Furniture, but yeah. They had this little band come in and play sets, and then Pioneer Furniture kind of, you know, so it was basically a 30-minute commercial with a band.
Right.
But yeah. And these were adults. But he played still guitar better than any adult in that area.
Picture in here?
No, I don't know.
I want to see a picture. All right. Yeah. So how long did that TV show run for? Was that like that was a weekly thing you were doing?
Yes, it was. And to me, I think it was about a year and a half, something like that. It ran long, those lines. Can you see that?
Oh, wait, I can see the guitar player, but I can't see you. You need to move it over. Yeah, now I can see you. Oh, my God, you're just, you're tiny. You're like, oh, my God, that's so funny.
And going to all these places and, you know, they played honky tonks and stuff. And, you know, here's this kid.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Are there recordings of that band or did it all just sort of vanish into the TV ether?
You know, I don't know about the video aspect of it, but I believe that John Landrum, who was the fellow sitting next to me, he was a tall guy, so he wanted to, didn't want to be a little giant there. His family recorded some of those things. I believe I have some tape of that. Yeah.
Okay. So in that picture, you're playing a double. It looks probably like a Fender Stringmaster or something. Like, are you that's a professional instrument. So at some point you must have upgraded from the student model to a pro model, right?
Yeah. Let me think about that. Let's see. The first thing that, that my father bought me was a triple neck magnetone. And I got away from the student thing, you know, and he bought the first one that I owned was the triple neck magnetone. And right. I had an E7, C6, and an F#7 on the back.
Triple eights or triple sixes?
Triple eights.
Wow. Yeah. A lot of strings for a 10-year-old.
Yeah, it was, and you know, so there may be some pictures of that guitar too. I'm sure I have probably a picture or two of it. And then the next one was the first pedal steel from Fender, the 1000, that came into West Texas. My dad was a truck driver for Phillips Petroleum. My mother didn't work at the time. Later she worked, but anyway, they laid out $1,000 in 1958.
Whoa, that's expensive.
That's a third of a car at that time. You know, you could buy a Chevrolet for $3,200 or whatever. Whoa. But anyway, they laid out that amount of money, and I had the first one, you know, in town. And I kept hearing all these pedal steel, you know, on the radio.
So what year would this have been? This is like early 50s?
No, mid-50s. You know, I believe that out in 58 is my best guess. Yeah.
Okay.
And I spent more time under it trying to figure out how to connect those things to make the sounds I was hearing. There wasn't anybody to teach you, you know, so I just came up with, you know, what seemed to work best, and I was pretty close.
So was that a double neck?
It was
10?
A double neck eight.
And how many pedals were on it?
There was eight pedals. There were room for 10, but there were eight, thankfully, because I had a big volume pedal that fit right in that little space.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, it was really a lot of fun doing that.
Was it kind of like an E9 C6 kind of thing with the eight strings, or how was it tuned?
Yeah, actually, with the eight string, you would go to E7. You didn't have the chromatics on the top. And right. So would be a E7th and then a C6th, G-E-C-A, G-E-C-A.
And were the pedals in those days kind of doing, like, was it the G-sharp to A move and the E to F-sharp move? Like, was it doing things like that?
Well, you know, the people that were doing all that and had a little different, I guess everybody had a little different pedal configurations, you know?
Yeah.
And
like, there probably wasn't really a standard yet, or was there?
No, there wasn't a standard. However, you know, some of the guys that were making the most money in Nashville and some of the better players, you know, were doing this, you know, those eight string too, until the tens came out.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think I ended up pretty much with the same. I can't remember the guy's name that I found out had first done that. The two steel guitar players in Nashville,
Lloyd Green,
and the guy that lived in Texas.
Like Weldon Myrick, or
no, he passed away not too long ago.
Not Buddy Emmons.
Buddy Emmons, Buddy. What
John Hughley or something like that.
No,
I don't know.
He had a thick kind of white, blonde hair at the time. Anyway, I'll think of his name. Anyway, I ended up with that configuration, you know, with that pedal on the right pedal and the left pedal that's used most. And so that was how I came up with the E7.
And there was no knee levers at this point?
No knee levers. And the interesting thing about it is that, you know, with those models, it's always a pull. It's a cable.
The cable, right.
And it goes around the turnbuckle, and you can only pull it one way. So what I did was I disconnected a couple that weren't needed, you know, on the right end of the pedals, and number 8, number 7, as I recall. And I hooked, and what I did was that I got a gate hinge, and I screwed it up into the bottom, and then I screwed a little paddle, a wooden paddle on the bottom side of it. And with an eye bolt, I hooked up one of those strings on the left. It was left knee right and right knee right. And that's what I used for a long, long time.
Like, you just came up with that, or did you see somebody using knee levers?
No, I knew. Well, I knew they had knee levers, but I knew I couldn't do that on that guitar unless I built something, you know, because they hadn't come out with the later 10 string models and that had, you know. So
was your left knee right, like dropping E's to E flats, or was it doing something different?
Left knee. Where's that book, honey? That
this is so nerdy.
That book up there, the steel guitar, and you got.
Lead me.
Right. Hold on, I'll be right back.
Okay.
I love it, Steve, that you know all this steel guitar stuff.
Oh well, you know.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me, especially this era where it was being invented. Like that, there's nothing cooler to me than like how it all, and everyone sort of has. It's funny, you know, like Lloyd Green has the exact same story about learning to play. Like it was door to door Hawaiian.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. He told me the exact same thing.
Wow.
And he was a little whippersnapper genius too. He was playing gigs by the time he was like 8 as well.
Yeah, that's cool.
Jimmy Day is the fella I was trying to think of.
Oh, okay, right, of course.
All right, let's see. Let me get over here into the...
And his setup is all backwards. Like, I'm used to the Emmons way, but Jimmy Day was, he was reverse of that.
That's exactly right, yeah. That we've got it. And so I just was going to see if there was any other info on that.
At this point in the show, I'd like to thank our amazing sponsors for the season. We couldn't do it without their support, and this year they are Mule Resophonics. Swing wider for inspiration with Mule Resophonic guitars. These are Resophonic guitars built for acoustic guitar players. Not just blues guitars, not just slide guitars. You don't need to play them in open tunings. They're set up with normal acoustic guitar action, and they have some of the best feeling necks in the game. Trust me, they're wicked. These musical tools wake up your ear and influence your playing towards uncharted musical realms. Check out the current lineup of guitars at the Mule Store at muleresophonic.com. Thanks to Deering. Deering Banjos make some of the finest instruments out there these days and caters to all levels as well. If you're just getting into the banjo, they offer their incredible Good Time series, which are high-quality instruments at lower prices. Deering Banjos are all made in the USA, and their website also features some incredible info on their products and just general banjo information. And now Deering is also making Pro Pick finger picks and thumb picks, and that's exciting because I've been using those finger picks for years. They make these cool ones with the fingertips missing, and I love those. They're the best. You can get info on the banjos and the finger picks over at DeeringBanjos.com. Union Tube and Transistor. Union is known for guitar effects pedals with a focus on quality and simplicity. They build durable, repairable products that sound amazing both on stage and in the studio. Their fuzz effects and compression pedals are insanely cool. I use the Sonebender Fuzz, the Moore pedal, the Lab, and the Swindle Overdrive all the time in sessions and live on stage. You can find out more about them at uniontone.com. And finally, the Henhouse Hang is a 3-day immersive recording experience at the Henhouse Studio in East Nashville with me, Steve Dawson. It'll be in September 2023 and then upcoming again in September of 2024. Join us for a musical learning experience like no other. We'll show you the ropes of recording roots in Americana music by bringing you in on a real session with real musicians working on real songs from the ground up. You can get all the info at stevedawson.ca. Just follow the links on the front page to the Hen House Hang. All right then, let's get back to the show. Okay, here's what I need to understand is, how are you learning all this stuff? Like, how was the transition going from playing Hawaiian tunes to actually getting into pedal steel? Like, did you just figure it out yourself, or did you have an actual pedal instructor?
No pedal instructor. I was sitting there with it by myself, you know.
Okay.
And I guess I was the first one in that area of West Texas, you know, to have one.
Really?
Later, the older guys started buying those. But I used I sold that steel to begin playing rock and roll with a rock and roll band.
Yeah.
Coming out of high school and going into college, well, I was invited to play with a group out of Midland, Texas, which was about 20 miles away from Odessa. And the drummer was in one of my classes. And he asked me, says, we're putting together a band. And he knew I played, at that particular point, I was playing rhythm in this little school thing.
Yeah.
And he said, would you like to come over and check it out? So I did. And we had a group called, there's a bunch of them called Mystics, but we called them Mystics. And played in that for a long time, probably 15, 16 months, something like that.
So did you start to get more interested in the guitar than you were the steel and sort of veer that way?
Yeah, I got away from the steel. I sold the steel and got a bigger amplifier and a Stratocaster guitar.
You didn't even own one anymore?
Didn't even own one for a while.
Crazy.
And so this went on, and then I joined with a band at called Fox, F-O-X-X, out of West Texas, and we were playing in Dallas at the Rickshaw Club, and the band leader wanted to do some country things. He knew that I used to play steel. So they went out and bought a Fire Engine Green 400. So 400, you know, is really one of the early, it was before the 1000s and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway, 400. And it was an 8-string. And so I just sat there. There wasn't room enough on the stage, because the stage was in a corner, so we were on a kind of a long side of a triangle, you know, facing the audience and or dancers. So the owner came up and put a little pedestal that's the same height as the stage right in front of my position. So we set the steel guitar out there, and I had a volume pedal running back. And for two songs a set, I'd go out there and play country music, you know.
Okay. So it was essentially a rock band. Like, you were playing guitar with this band, and then you'd hop down to the steel. That's so cool.
We played in every kind of place you imagine in Texas, you know. But International Hotel, I remember we played in the across the foyer from the main auditorium, which Elvis was in at the time, and opening up for what's the gal's name?
Tina Turner.
Tina Turner. Tina Turner.
Come on.
We're opening up for them in the casino ballroom.
Amazing.
So that's pretty cool. But it was in that band that they got me to start playing steel guitar, and they own the steel guitar, okay? So that will come into play here in a second. But one of the guys from Kenny Rogers, Mickey Jones, came in there. They were in town. And
so this was the first edition, the band, the first edition,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, first edition. Okay. So he came in and saw me playing steel guitar and told Kenny about it. And here's a long-haired steel guitar player. And what I didn't know at the time was Kenny was going to produce a group that ended up being Shiloh. you know a little bit about that group.
Well, I know you were in that, and Don Henley was in that band too, right?
Yeah, and the Bowdens, you know, Mike and Richard Bowden.
Crazy.
And,
yeah.
And had a keyboard player, but he got killed. He was killed on a scooter, wonderful motorcycle. They had a little place out in Linden, Texas, off of the highway that they had, one of the highways in the country, where they had their rehearsal things, and they had their motorcycles and stuff, and he got killed, and Jim Ed Norman took his place. They had just talked to him. He was going to North Texas State there in Dallas. And so Kenny sent word to them to go and see me. So then here they come. They come in there while we're playing, and they're standing all around this pedestal there waiting for me to play that steel guitar.
So were they looking for a steel guitarist?
Yeah, yeah, they wanted somebody because they're going to play country rock, you know.
Okay.
So I don't know if you've ever heard of the Shiloh album or not, heard it, but Kenny Rogers was responsible for that.
Yes.
It's a good one to locate if you can find them. But they asked me to come up to the Piney Woods up there. It was, you know, kind of an hour and a half drive, something like that. And I borrowed the band's steel guitar.
Yeah.
And went up there and sat in with them and played. And they started playing all these things like Dillard and Clark and like Sweetheart of the Rodeo and stuff like that, you know. And I said, man, this feels great, because that's in my blood, you know, country music. And they told me into joining the group. And so I had to find another steel guitar. So I had to do military drills. I had to make up a lot of drills out in California where I had been living for a while. And no matter where I moved to, I'd go back out there and make up drills. I had a sergeant major that would let me stay in his house. He lived real close to the airport, so I could take a taxi over there, stay with him, go to work with him down in Fort MacArthur. Yeah.
Had you enlisted, or how did this Army thing come about?
Yeah, when the war started over there in Vietnam, I had some friends tell me, you better get into the Guard or something, or you're gonna have to go over there. So I had to go through basic training and all that stuff, basic training out in El Paso and advanced infantry training up in Fort Knox. And I got out of there, and I still had to make all the drills and the summer camps and all that stuff. You know, thankfully they didn't call us up, you know, for
a duty. Relief. Yeah.
Because I had a bad MOS, which is your designation. I was trained to be a point man, you know, for reconnaissance. And like in World War II, reconnaissance was the guys out there with a Jeep with a 30 caliber machine gun, three of them, and they would go out and check out and see where the other enemy was, you know.
Yep.
But in Vietnam, you had no Jeeps. You had to be a point man, which is the first guy to hit the trap.
Yes.
You know, so I wouldn't be here if I had to go over there. I wouldn't be here. So thankfully, God provided a way for me to stay with Sergeant Major Campbell. And he took me to work with him for a week. That made up 3 months of drills that I could be gone 3 months and go play with this new band.
Wow, cool. Okay, so they sort of accommodated your weird schedule.
Yeah. And the other interesting point is that Shiloh was going to move to California. So I had been out there once before with another group, and it didn't pan out. And so I met them. I was supposed to meet them after I did my drills in what was another town up there north of Denver? I can't remember the little town. They were playing in a little town north of Denver up in the mountains. Mm-hmm. So they were going to pick me up at Denver Airport. So I had to have this steel guitar. So the fellow that built the amps that I still use, Bob Reese, he's passed now, but Reese amps, I always used them. He had tube amps, you know, that I still use. And so he knew everybody at Fender because he used to work there, you know. So he called over there and said, does anybody know if there's an old 1,000 or 2,000 or something steel guitar that's available? I said, you know, there's they looked around and said, yeah, there's a blonde 1000 like I had, mm-hmm. with petals, and that nobody ever picked up. And so, well, how much you want for it? And they said, $250. So I threw $250 down and picked it up, got on the plane and went up there, and I had a steel guitar.
Amazing.
So later on, I put on the same, you know, put on those knee livers, you know, I was telling you about.
With gate hinges again?
Oh, gate hinges, yeah.
You
yeah.
did?
So anyway, yeah. In fact, you know, I'm trying to think of it. I don't know if I did the gate hinges at all on the first one. It might have been just the second one, come to think okay. of it. But I had to have them, you know. I had to.
So before we leave this Texas thing, were you, like, did you cross paths with, like, you know, Doug Somm and people like that, that were, like, in that real hardcore sort of Texas rock and roll country scene in those days? Or were you just kind of on your own with the band that you were playing in?
Yeah, just on our own, playing clubs. And we had a manager that out of Odessa, Texas, that he was driving a delivery truck for some company out there, you know, in the oil field. And he wanted to get out of it, so he ended up buying a couple of honky-tonks. One of them was one that had country music in it. We didn't play in that one. We played in the one where it had more rock and roll in it. And he became our manager, and he was the one who was finding these places for us to play in Houston and in Dallas.
Okay.
And that's how it got us up there, yeah. So we got out to California, and immediately, Kenny wanted to get us in a studio and record. We did one album together, and then...
So that Shiloh record, can you tell me a bit about, like, was that your first real studio experience, and where'd you do it, and was it easy for you, or was it a real challenge?
It wasn't the first experience with this group, Fox. We came up to Nashville and recorded a record up. Actually recorded two. One was released, one wasn't. And we ended up doing that record, and everybody started getting offers. I had an offer from somebody had seen us play and told the Flying Rio Brothers manager that there was another long-haired steel guitar player in town besides PDP.
Yeah.
So anyway, they called me and said, would you like to come out to the beach house in Santa Monica and audition, you know, for this band, Flying Reavers. I'd never heard of them. So I went out there, and Bernie Ledden was still in the group, of course, and I went out there and auditioned. And of course, Graham had left, and I met him later whenever
they sort of kicked him out, right?
Yeah, I don't know what the deal was exactly, but you know, but I ended up playing them on his records, but later on with him and Emmy. Most of the recording came by way of the second time I was out there, you know, with Shiloh.
Okay.
And Kenny would use me on some of his things, you know, and actually took me up there. Kenny did a TV show that was based out of Canada. And he actually took me and a keyboard player up there to do help with the show up there. And a lot of these opportunities came through Kenny.
And was he producing a bunch of other, I didn't realize that he was a producer. Like, was he doing that a lot back then?
You know, of course they, I'm not sure if they were self-produced on all of those. I got some of their records I could see. But I don't know how much of it he did, but he really took Shiloh under his wing, mm-hmm. and so we would have probably did pretty good, you know, if we'd all stayed together. But we all had other opportunities, and I kind of left, and then everybody.
So you're sitting in this studio, and Kenny Rogers is producing you, though. That's pretty cool. I guess, like, at the time, he was sort of a rock star, right? Like,
yeah.
See what condition my condition was in, was out, and, you know, he was a rock star. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you joined the Burrito Brothers, so just to clarify, like, Sneaky Pete had left the band, Graham had either left or been kicked out at that point, and they were sort of revamping, right? It was still kind of the same lineup. I don't remember what the exact lineup was when you joined, but you were replacing Sneaky Pete.
Yes. That's correct.
And were you aware of him? Like, did you know his playing, and did you know kind of how far out it was and stuff?
I didn't until they gave me the records to learn, and then I.
Okay.
Then I,
so you got the gig.
I got the gig, and Graham was replaced by Rick Roberts.
Okay.
And Rick Roberts was a good tenor singer, great singer. So it was kind of a revamping, you know. But it, and we did the one live record that Eddie Kramer, from Electric Ladyland came out with Remote. I was so proud to meet him. He was one of my heroes.
Oh my God, that's so cool.
And so I got he invited me to come up to their studio in New York, and he had shown me all around, you know, Electric Ladyland.
Electric Lady?
Yeah.
Oh wow.
So I really loved that time. And anyway, we were rocking it out. And
so that was Last of the Red Hot Burritos. That's the live record when you joined. Eddie Kramer did it. Do you remember what was it from one gig or was it from a tour?
Three different. We recorded at three different universities in the Northeast.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's probably listed on the record, but I can't remember exactly which ones they were. And it was it was during this time that we were up there, and Stills was out on his own.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, the Birds helped them, I think, in some areas out in L.A. But we wanted to go see them, and they were up in the Northeast somewhere, closer to the Great Lakes. I think it was Michigan.
Or Cincinnati. Was it Cincinnati or Cleveland?
Cleveland. Yeah, we went up there to see them, and we sat out there and just weren't going to try to get backstage or anything, but... our drummer, he could talk his way into any place. He said, "Oh, I'm going to go see Stills," you know. And so he went, "Okay, go see him." So he was up there for a long time. And then Stills came on, and he said, "Stills wants us to come to his hotel afterwards," you know. So he had in mind that Stills was already starting this Manassas record, not called Manassas, you know, Ben, and. He wanted us to come. He wanted us not to fly back from our weekend jaunts, but to come down to Florida and record with him. So we did the first time. And
had you met him before?
I had not met him before. No.
Okay. So before you move on from that, like with the Burritos, and I would imagine it was a lot due to what you were learning from the Sneaky Pete era, like there's all kinds of crazy effects and you've got like a really fuzzed out tone on a bunch of those tunes, and that carries over into Manassas as well. Tell me a little bit about like the guitar you were playing and whatever you remember about that sound, because that tone to me is so unreal, and that's where it really becomes your thing sort of veers off from Sneaky Pete. So I'm really interested in that sort of era, in what you were playing through, like instrument wise and effects for those kind of sounds.
On the album, I had that steel guitar that I told you that I put the knee levers on, knee levers. It was a double eight. And that's the one I used for the first recording down there, recordings down there from Manassas. And I believe down there he provided the amplifiers. I can't remember what kind of amplifier I used. However, on stage, I used what they had for Sneaky, which was a Showman top and 215s that were spread clear across either side of the stage in their own cab.
Yeah. Cool.
So... If I had a stereo rig, I could have, you know, really did some cool things with it. But that was basically the outfit that I had, and with basically a Fender head. But the fuzz face was the key with the edgy sound that you're talking about.
Yeah.
I gave one to not Jim Ed Norman, but somebody else. I gave a couple away, and I still got one.
So it was a fuzz face, like it was one of those early generation fuzz face pedals.
Yeah.
And did you plug it in like from the steel into the fuzz face into the volume pedal so that it was always fuzzy, or were you working the volume into the fuzz?
Yeah, I think I was working the volume into the fuzz.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And so, man, It's I had this funky foot pedal, and I finally got a low profile. But the one I had was from years and years ago when I was learning to play, and it stood up about, I don't know if you can see that, about that tall. You know,
real high. Yeah.
It wasn't a low profile at all, and of course, you know, your knee would be up higher. It didn't matter too much because I only had one knee lever to worry about on that guitar. Right. But I soon got rid of that, got a low profile, you know. And so it's...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
So all that stuff with the Live Burritos record and the Manassas stuff is all done on the double eights with your crazy self-rigged knee lever. And wow.
The first time I went to a multiple string was the first record that I did one of those on. I remember running into Tom Brumley because he was my hero, you know. I wanted to sound him, got to meet him and all, and we were friends at this time. And we during the second recording, Manassas recording, I had purchased his old. I'd given mine, sold it to a friend in Texas. The double eight, he still has it, I think, that double eight Fender. And I got Tom's guitar because it had a low E. It had 11 strings on the E9th, and I couldn't do without that low E with a lot of stuff that I do. And so we talked a little bit and ended up buying that, and I'd had it for 2 weeks, and I had a little apartment up in North Hollywood there, and I was learning, you know, how to touch and feel and, you know, work that, and the strings were higher and closer together. So yeah. I was really, really struggling to get used to it. In comes a call for me to come down to the studio, and it was a Rolling Stones gig that I did there, and Toy and Frame. And
so that was an overdub call.
Yes, that was an overdub call. They had been recording in France.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
So this is a funny story. So I got in the car and went down there. It was evening time. And so I came through the studio door. Actually, you could go after you came in the back of the studio there. You could either go to the right to the control room or the left into the regular room. And I noticed that they had mics up in the room. I knew they had been recording, but there was a vocal mic up. And they said, come on in, you know, come on in. And if you'd like to go direct, you know, come on in. We'll set you up at the other end of the console.
Did you know who the session was for, or had they told you?
Yeah, I knew it was.
Okay.
So I set up at the end of the console, facing the console at the opposite end of where I came in. And it was in levels, you know, you came in, there were some seats in front of the control room window, a big window, and there's seats in front of it, and then a layer where the console was, and then there was a balcony kind of a thing, you know. Maybe not a balcony thing, but it was all on that same level. And so I sat there facing the guys, you know. So it seemed like a menagerie almost. It was Keith was dressed in a swashbuckler outfit, literally. It looked like they'd come from a costume party. He looked like, you know, he reminds you of a pirate anyway, you know,
yeah.
Me. And his wife was about 8 months pregnant, and she had this tight exercise bumblebee striped suit on, which accentuated the fact that she was expecting.
Yeah.
So here I am trying to make some sense out of a guitar that I've had for 2 weeks. And
oh my God.
And this was going on. Not only that, they said, Nick is going to sing the vocals. And I said, you know, I got plenty of time. And I saw the mic out there with a stand for music stand. And I said, well, I can wait. And that wasn't the idea. The idea was he wanted me to feel like it was a live experience. So oh. He had a hand mic and yeah. He did a stage routine on this creaky end of this wooden stage, and my steel's moving around, and he's singing it, and all around me, just so that I got a feel for a live performance. They wanted a live performance.
That is crazy and awesome.
Crazy. And so I played it down one time, and I missed a couple of spots. Played it down the second time, I did pretty good. Third time, that's the take I think they took. And each time, he's singing, running around with that microphone.
Oh, my God. So was Jimmy Miller there? Like, who was involved in that session? Jimmy Miller was the producer, I guess, and Glenn Johns was the engineer. Were all those guys there?
Yeah, those were the suit guys. You know, they go into studios with suits on. So we had, like two or three guys in suits, you know, those guys and whoever was with them. You know, I didn't really get to talk with them much, you know, but my... That was pretty wild.
That is so crazy. What can you tell me about the Manassas session? Like, that first record is so organic. Like, it must have been done pretty much live, I'm guessing, rather than like overdubbed in bits. But can you just tell me a bit about, it's a big band, and can you tell me about how the whole thing went down? And was Stills, like, did he have a pretty specific vision of how everyone would fit together? Or was it just kind of like a jam that evolved, that turned into that record?
He had all this idea in his mind, you know, there are four different sides with four different styles of music. And the countryside was what he wanted us down there for initially. So we came down there for that. And everything, you're right, it was back then that studio was the MCI testing grounds. So they had an MCI console and the new MCI 16 track machine.
Yeah.
So that was your testing grounds down there. And Howie and Ron were our engineers during that time. But I mean, Stephen would go, he'd start in the early evening and go all night. He'd sleep during the day. And that was kind of different for especially me and Chris, you know. And, so we kind of gravitated into it, I guess. And so we would do, we wouldn't do any more than four takes, I would say, on average, three mm-hmm. to four takes, maybe five sometime. And that'd be it, you know. And you don't, there's no really overdubbing. He would, what he had in mind, he was going to piece together parts that he needed if he couldn't get a whole single run. So they would spend... We've been there recording, you know, up into the wee hours, but then he'd spend up till daybreak with one of them go sleep, and the other engineer would stay with him or rotate. But anyway, he'd piece together those things and put together the things that needed, you know, the way he liked them.
And was he doing all his vocals live and stuff too? Like, was that sort of set up like a gig essentially, or was it all through isolation and headphones and whatnot?
There's a later version of the CD that came out. I'll see if I can get her to find out. I'll show it to you. It's a picture of our setup from up in the rafters.
And that's from the original session.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, cool.
That's for the original sessions, but it came out on an aftermarket thing, you know. And I think we can find that for you. But Chris, he really didn't like those hours of working, you know. He always kind of, I don't know, sorry, Dal, sorry to get you into this, you know. So, but no, it's fine, you know, I was enjoying it, you know.
So you rolled with it. You would sleep during the day too and get up in the evening and go into the studio all night. And that's just how you rolled for a while.
Yeah, I think probably we just kind of tried to change our settings, you know?
Yeah.
But
like, it's interesting because the burritos, as great and kind of like legendary as they are, when you think back on them, they didn't really have like the commercial success anywhere close to what Stills had had at that point. So it must, was it kind of intimidating in a way playing with a guy like that, that had achieved like kind of superstardom at that point in his career and he was sort of looking for a new direction?
Yeah. You know, I really didn't follow that music as much, you know, as I probably could have, but I was aware of the success of Crosby, Stills and Nash and all of those, things that they were involved in, and they were sort of taking a break, as I understand it, from each other, doing their own
thing, yeah,
you know. And so it was just a special time, I guess, you know. And then,
well, it's a special record. It sounds amazing, and your playing is so killer on it.
Oh, thanks. It's just, thank the Lord, because sometimes it'd be the first time you heard this song.
Yeah,
trying to find your way around, but. Hallelujah, you know.
They don't make records like that anymore with bands that that big, making that much of a racket that sounds so great.
Yeah. You know, you got 100 tracks you can fill up, and then you have to spend all that time going through them. It's better not to have that many tracks and just know what you're going to do, you know, as much as...
Yeah. With Manassas, it always feels to me like, I mean, I wasn't there, and I wasn't even born really at this time, but... it seems to me like Stills always had one foot out the door because he was always, he was sort of on the verge of going back to CSNY at that point, or CSN or whatever it was at that point. Did you guys tour? And like, were you committed in some way to that band? Okay, so how long did that go on for?
Well, the first tour we did was, of course, I'll back up just a little bit. Steven he knew he had to have a surgery on a foot. I believe it was a foot. And he was going to do that in December, late November, December, and then recuperate in Elstead in south of England, where he had that big house, you know, Peter Sellers' old house. And I think,
really?
I think one of the Beatles had it for a while too. But anyway, it was a wonderful place. And it had a billiards room out by a pond, just in a little river coming by. So he converted that billiards room into a rehearsal room. There's pictures of that too. And the place where they had built, all this was there whenever he got it. The house itself was really old, but there was new. Peter Sellers put in like a 5-car garage with a cinema over the top, you know.
Awesome.
So what happened was the road crew converted the cinema up there. It had restrooms, showers, and all that stuff. They had like military bunks, you know, and they stayed up in that place. And we put all of our gear underneath what wasn't being used, you know, in a 5-car garage. We put cases, and then we set up in further, closer down to the creek, in that billiards room. And we just left it set up and go down there and play till our heart's desire and come back. And he had people to take care of the fire and, you know, the fireplaces and people to cook. And
so it was comfortable.
It was very comfortable. Yes.
And what was Stills like to work for at that point? Was he a creative, you know, interesting dude like that he seems to be?
Yeah. You know, there was a separation of sorts at that point, because I've never done the drugs, you know, and they would all, you know, snort and whatever, you know, was around. They were into
it. Yeah.
But I just never got into that. So I missed a lot of the quote social time, you know, there. But there was plenty of Paul Harris and I, we would, you know, go down to the village, or we'd do stuff together too. So we all had our own little places in that nice home. And someone that Johnny's Garden, that song Johnny's Garden, there was a real Johnny that maintained that the grounds. And he had a place out near the carriage house where he lived. And so it was just amazing time, really. And we went out and did a couple of things in London, just kind of sneak in to sneak out, you know, just. And I think we went over to Amsterdam and did one show over at the Concertgebouw. That's their big hall. And before we toured. And when we toured, we left England, flew to Tel Aviv, and to Bangkok.
Whoa.
And to, did we stop in China or someplace? We made one more stop before we flew to Perth, which is the northern part of Australia. We came from wintertime into summertime. And we got out,
I'll say.
We got out of that plane in the middle of the night for customs. And here's these brown guys, you know, those police guys with shorts on, you know, the Australian hats, you know, turned up. And here we are in coats and stuff, getting over there and going through customs. And finally, we were making our way down to the south of Australia to drive in all the way out to a place called Mowalla, which they had the Mowalla Rock Festival. And that's the first big gig that we played.
Oh, okay.
And then when we left there, we played at the, I think it's called the HIU. It's in Honolulu. It's a big indoor venue. And so we played there, and then we started our tour in America. And
I mean, Stills was like as big as you can get as far as like rock stars go at that time. That was like 73, 74, probably. Like, were those crowds coming out from Manassas? I'm guessing they probably were, right?
Yeah, mainly on his record, you know.
Yeah.
You know, just people knowing Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and just knowing all about his music, you know.
How did that lead to working with Graham? Like, at some point, it seems like your career like heavily veered into the studio, and that sort of seems like maybe that was kind of one of those first early things where you were like a session guy all of a sudden. Yeah. Was that a conscious decision for you?
Not really. Just calls just came in, you know, and I guess if you do good, if you do well on one thing. I was able to play on some Kenny Rogers things, and when Graham came and brought Emmy Lou over, those things, it took a while for those to take off, but at Graham's death, that turned a lot of attention on that, on his music and that style too.
So that first record, the GP one that you did with him, like, he was probably pretty messed up at that time, I'm guessing, And interestingly to me, also Rick Gretsch, or Greck, I don't know how you pronounce his name, but he was the bass player from Blind Faith, produced that record, which is cool. Emmy Lou's there. James Burton was there.
Yeah.
Buddy Emmons is on that record too.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit about that session. Like, were you overdubbing, or were you involved in the live tracks, or how did that all go down?
Well, yeah, we did it on the first album. That's when Buddy played on two or three songs, and then I played on two or three songs, I think. And
were you there at the same time as him?
No, it would have been different sessions. Yeah.
Okay.
And Glenn D. Harden did all the charts. I've still got one in my suitcase.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man. That's so cool.
He did meticulous, beautiful charts. And so he was the session leader, you know. And so I remember, funny thing about that now, I had my steel guitar in the room with everybody else. And I was running direct back then, because back then you could run direct into anybody's board virtually. In Los Angeles, they all had tube limiters, which the warmness of the tube, whether it goes to an amplifier or whatever. So I brought my little pig nose amplifier and set it on a stool. I put this little pig nose, it looked just like this.
I love those things.
Yeah.
Yeah, they haven't changed much since the 70s, have they?
Anyway, that might have been that one. I had it on there just so I could turn it up and hear myself play.
I've never put a steel through a pig nose, but it must be pretty raunchy.
Well, somebody, and I can't prove this, but somebody put a microphone in front of that thing, but when I was paying no attention, and I said, surely they didn't use it. It doesn't sound like they used it, but I was freaked out whenever I thought, oh, no. But anyway, that was a funny thing. But the charts were meticulous. I mean, they were just great. And had slightly different players on the second album, you know.
Was Graham around for those sessions, or was he sort of in and out? Or
oh, no.
Like, I know he was not in great shape, right?
No, I didn't know that he was doing any drugs. I mean, I wasn't a drug.
Okay.
But he was lucid and just right on the money and just playing. He'd play every song with us. And I'm sure they overdubbed their vocals, but Emmy Lou was there. So they were singing with us to give us the feel of the song. And so, yeah, I mean, he did real well on both albums.
And Emmy Lou was there from the beginning, too, yeah. of those records. That must have kind of blown your mind. Like, she's pretty phenomenal.
Yeah, she... Chris met her when we were playing what is the name of that little club down in Washington, outside of Washington, D.C.?
It's in Georgetown.
Georgetown. I can't remember. It was a popular place. But anyway, one of the band, when we were playing with the Flying Burrito Brothers and playing at this club, heard Emmy Lou down in another club and told Chris. Chris went down there and just fell in love with her voice. And he kind of had in mind, he wanted to do kind of what was ended up, you know, with Graham. But he told Graham about her and that's how she met Graham.
Cool.
And they had her out there in LA.
Did working on records like that, like I know those records also are way bigger in hindsight than they were at the time. Like, they weren't huge records. Now they're revered as like some of the greatest country rock records ever made. But at the time, they kind of essentially flopped. Did they help you as far as your session career kind of launch?
They must have. I mean, they're, you know, I think when you mention that, the Rolling Stones session probably, most likely, and I'm pretty sure, came from the fact that Graham was hanging out with them over in France.
Yep. Right.
I think that's what put that together. Yeah.
Because that led to, like, you worked with, like, I mean, your credit list from that point seems to just, like, skyrocket. So were you basically in L.A. that whole time? And were you, how busy were you as a session guy during those, like, mid-70s through 80s years?
Yeah, it seemed really... Really good, you know, for especially during the 70s and 80s changed a little bit. Of course, music was changing but in the 80s. That's, you know, punk and everything.
Yeah.
They're tearing everything apart, you know. But I think the 70s would have been the key for all the other things.
Like, Were you involved in sessions like multiple times every week, all year long, kind of thing? Or
for the most part, during that heavy time, that was really a rich time for doing sessions, you know. And it did begin to slack up in the 80s, you know, a little bit just because of the music changing, you know.
Yeah,
got up here and immediately Emmy wanted to start the Nash Ramblers, you know, so. So
had you kept in touch with her? Like, had you played with her over the years? I guess you'd done a few records with her through the 80s and stuff, right?
No, I never did really, you know, I know she...
Oh, okay.
She called for me to play once or twice during that time, and I couldn't do it. And
okay.
So I've forgotten who all had played steel in those years, but yeah, a couple of three other guys. And then... I don't remember how we connected to...
At a Christmas party.
Christmas party, that's right.
Oh, yeah.
And the Christmas party. And So she was thinking about putting together this idea, you know, in her head, and became the Nash Ramblers.
And what a band. So that was you and the Roy Husky Jr., who's like just one of the most legendary bass players ever. Sam Bush, right?
Right.
And who was playing guitar in that band?
It's just
John Randall.
John Randall, yeah.
Oh, okay, right. And so that record, that you guys did that live record, the Live at the Ryman thing, which sort of gets credit for bringing the Ryman back to life.
Yeah.
Was that like a concept from the beginning? Was like, hey, let's put this band together and do this crazy concert at the Ryman? And or was it just like a weird fluke, or how did that all come together?
I believe it came from the fact that Emmy is so conscious of the meaning of that building, you know, and the history of that building, that she just couldn't see it torn down or disrupted, you know. And I think it was her love for that music and love for what it stood for and how many artists have been there. So I think without that, I don't know if it'd still be there, you know.
Was it in pretty rough shape in those days?
Apparently so, yeah. They had to do some work on it, you know. But but anyway, I was glad to be a part of that. Being on that stage was really special.
So that live record, was that just one concert? That was one night, one concert?
Let's see. I think that we did two nights there, it seems to me like.
Okay.
And can't be sure if we did a third one or not. We came back and played there again later on, you know, but in the beginning.
On that album, I think you play a little bit of banjo and maybe a little guitar, but basically you're the dobro player. Yeah. Was dobro something you'd always play? Like, had you always done that? Or was that something you picked up more along the way in later years? Or what was your relationship with the dobro?
You know, it went all the way back to us traveling with Stephen Stills. We played at the University of Tennessee over there in Knoxville. And we always did like an acoustic set in the middle of the set, you know, the main show for Manassas. And
cool.
Chris and I, of course, Stephen would come out and he'd play either guitar or banjo or piano, but he wanted us to go out there and play a little something too. So Chris and I'd go out there and play. And at first, you know what, I just played guitar with him, I guess, or banjo. I had a little banjo, I think, at that time. And we got to thinking about the dobro. And we were playing at the University of Tennessee, and a lot of the university kids were helping us set up the stage and all. And I put out the word, said, you don't know, this is the right part of the country for it, but you don't know if anybody has a dobro for sale. And lo and behold, they asked a couple of people and said, you know, we think we know where one is. And he came wagging this thing back, and it been up in a hayloft or something for a long time, picking out little pieces of hay. And it was just a funky little cheap thing, but we played that thing for on our set. You know, we played it on Manassas. And then later on, when Chris was going out on his own in the 80s, you know, stuff, well, I would wag that thing around too. And when he did Sugar Hill Records, I think he did two of those. I think the dobro was that funky little dobro.
I remember
when we were out, he and I playing some of these folk things, some folk and bluegrass things back east, and we saw Jerry Douglas, and I said, he wanted to see this dobro, and I showed him his dobro. Of course, it was way miles worse than what he had, you know. So I ended up getting one like him, you know. And I had a nice relationship with Gibson since one of Dolly's cousins started working there, you know. Started working for I guess it started out in California where they were first making the dobros, you know, and then they sold out or whatever, and then Richie and another friend of his took it to Gibson, and then they made it.
And they did there's like an Al Perkins model dobro at that time, right?
Yeah, there's a thing here is a picture.
Oh, yeah.
And you said
probably. I can, yeah. Do you have a few of those kicking around?
Of the Dobros?
Yeah.
I think we got one of the originals.
And your son has one and you have one.
And I gave one to one of my sons. And then I kept the main one.
They don't make that, or I guess they don't make Dobros at all anymore, right?
I think they're probably out of the Dobro business by now. Yeah,
I think.
They sure gave me a lot of promotion,
Yeah, that's great.
In return.
After all this amazing session work that you did in the 80s and 90s, I mean, I could ask you a million questions, but I know you have to go soon, but I'm just curious about things for you recently. Like, where are you at? Are you trying to not work as much now? Are you staying off the road? I noticed that you're playing on records, like you played on a big Miranda Lambert record last year. Are you actively looking to do sessions and playing, or where are you at right now?
You know, I'm just kind of happy taking care of the yard out here, we got a lot of it to take care of it. But anyway, I enjoy doing the sessions. I think my touring days are over, but I think that the sessions, I always enjoy them, They're not as plenteous as it used to be, but I understandably the music has changed, the artists have changed. And that's going to happen. But yeah, I mean, I get to play a couple of times here and there. And that.
Are you selective about sessions? Like, if somebody calls you and they're like, "Hey, I got a session for some guy," and you don't know who it is, will you do it, or are you kind of like, "Eh"?
You know, the only thing that I have really been a stickler for is just crude lyrics and stuff. I don't want to be a part of that. Other than that, if they're not slandering the Lord or doing something else that's weird, too weird, then I usually...
You're good to go.
Yeah.
And do you keep up with the steel playing stuff, or do you just play it when you're doing a session, or like how fit are you on the steel?
I've got one sitting up here behind me that I sit down every once in a while just to keep limbered up, And I get probably, I guess in the sessions I'm doing now, probably a good... 50 to 60% are pedal steel.
Okay, and the rest would be dobro, banjo, guitar, whatever else.
Yeah, just odd thing, or lap steel. I enjoy playing the lap steel too. And mm-hmm. A lot of people want a little rock edge or something. We'll do that.
What's your current steel that you play in these days?
It's made in Australia.
Oh,
guy who's an absolute genius. It's called the Anapeg. Steel guitar. His name,
oh, never heard of that.
It's a keyless. It just plays like glass. I mean, just so smooth, And his pickups are, he's worked on the pickups since I first met him back in, when we were down there with Dolly, 87, 88 time frame. That's when I met him. He came to see me to show me his guitar. And I thought, this is really, it's a real short thing because it doesn't have the keys,
It must be lighter too, though, right?
It's not necessarily lighter because the wood is very dense. It's very, whole tuning well, and playing changes in climate. And man, it just, I played the thing and I've got, he's made me three through the course of, how many years would that be? 91, 2, or something like that? Was it 91 or 2? I think I got the first one. So it's been a while, but I've got three of them.
Wow, cool. Well, I've never heard of that brand. That's so cool. So it's Australian.
Australian made, yeah. He's about to retire.
It was always more like a boutique special order sort of steel guitar. He never was like in stores.
He wasn't mass manufacturing them.
Right.
He'd go out to the outback, mind you, and get these standard trees, which is probably against the law to get them, But he would have to, they have to carry guns to fight off the animals, that are vicious out there. And then they'd cut those things and they'd probably be about 100 miles out, 70, 80, 100 miles out. They would cut all the wood, cover it up with chips so it wouldn't dry out prematurely, and cover that up, carry it back. And then he had a kiln, and he would age this wood for a year or so. before before he had even started working. It's amazing dedication.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah. So, Al, are you going to be playing anywhere around Nashville at all in the next while? Like, do you gigs around anymore?
You know, I don't know of any right now. They seem to pop up, you know, just, hey, come and play.
Yeah.
You know, but we'll try to give you a holler if we do.
Well, listen, thanks so much. I really appreciate the time and the hassle of getting this together. It's great to talk to you. And
sorry it took so many turns there to get it going.
So worth it.
Well, thank you very much. My pleasure.
Okay. And thanks to Pamela for helping out too, for the tech support.
Oh, tech support. Yeah. Tech support's in the house. Tech support's in the Thank you, Steve.
Thank you so much.
For bearing with us old folks. And thanks.
Not a problem at all.
Thanks for promoting the music and steel guitar players.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love it.
Appreciate you. You have a good.
I appreciate you guys too. All right. Have a great day.
Now I gotta figure out how to turn this thing off.
Thank you so much for tuning in and listening, everybody. Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast is produced at the Henhouse Studio in East Nashville, Tennessee. Please remember to subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. You can find more info on this episode, including show notes and an audio playlist for Spotify and Apple Music at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Thank you again to our sponsors this season, Union Tube and Transistor, Spectra 1964, The Deering Banjo Company, Mule Resonator Guitars, and The Henhouse Hang. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time for another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. Over and out.